Our second case this morning is United States against Dean. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Good morning. Appellant requests that this court hold the government to its original promise contained in the pretrial agreement and disapprove any sentence which includes detention in excess of 24 months. What we have in this case is an appellant who entered into a stipulation of fact with the government, admitting to the misconduct for which he was charged at the court-martial before this court. He then entered into a pretrial agreement with the convening authority and fulfilled every promise of that pretrial agreement, except for the last one. And on the eve of the trial, the government learned of other misconduct that was unrelated to the offenses before the court. And at that point, the government improperly withdrew from the pretrial agreement. In this case, the military judgment permitted the convening authority to withdraw, basically because under 705, the convening authority could only withdraw under three specific grounds. And one of those grounds is if the appellant has, they cannot withdraw if the appellant has begun performance. And in this case, the appellant did begin performance. And the government was bound to that agreement at that time. 705 itself does not require detrimental reliance. And the appellant would argue that in this case, because he had begun performance, this court need not even get to detrimental reliance and should simply hold the government to the terms of 705.
Yeah, the government would say they're holding the appellant to the terms of paragraph 3. What's wrong with their argument there? They say that paragraph 3 contemplates that the agreement may be canceled if there's a failure to arrive at an agreement with the trial counsel on the contents of the stipulation of fact or any modification of the stipulation without my consent.
And that's paragraph 3A, and probably has two contentions with paragraph 3 of the pretrial agreement. The first would be that paragraph 3 contains three provisions in which the agreement may be canceled. The first two go to appellant's right to cancel. In that term, first off, if the government would have modified the pretrial agreement without his consent, then it would be the appellant's right to then withdraw from the agreement. And even if that is not the case, paragraph 3A, the judge hit the nail on the head when he said during trial, isn't it true, counsel, that the government could request a modification if there was a material error or omission? And in this case, what the government was requesting was a modification based upon uncharged misconduct that did not relate to the pretrial agreement or the court martial in this case. And this court should not just read 3A by itself. It should look to the terms of paragraph 1B, which says specifically that the stipulation would only go to the offenses of which the appellant was pleading guilty. This court in Davis is also, or Manley, has also recognized that the appellant should only be, the pretrial agreement should only be interpreted to require appellants only to stipulate to those charges which are before the court and which are the subject of the pretrial agreement. So that's where the judge really erred, is that he determined that this was a basis, or a proper basis, for the government to withdraw, because apparently, looking at Kazana, said that this was a reasonable basis for the convening authority to reassess the sentence. But the appellant wasn't going to be sentenced at this court-martial for the offenses of the alleged larceny and false official statement that occurred on 9 October. So it really wasn't a proper basis for the government to withdraw.
Counsel, would you agree that the government could have put as a condition in the pretrial agreement that it would be, that basically the convening authority could withdraw if the accused committed any misconduct?
And that's exactly the appellant's point, Your Honor, that the government really holds all the cards when they're doing the pretrial agreement. And if they desired such a term, they should have required one from the defense when they submitted the deal. And if they did not do so, then you cannot imply that there's a term in here that says, contrary to what the government has argued in their brief, that there's an implied term that he would have not conducted any misconduct.
What's your response to the government's argument and the military judge's finding that the stipulation having been concluded before the pretrial agreement, he was doing something in anticipation of an agreement, not in reliance upon it?
That generally is supported by the case law that the stipulation alone, but it would not constitute performance. However, in this case, the appellant has performed several promises. Paragraphs 1B through 1F required appellants to do several things, including waiving a motion, selecting forum, waiving specifically named witnesses, and then requesting only two non-local witnesses. So he did perform.
So is it your position that he did not begin performance with the stipulation of fact?
And in this case, the appellant can see that absolutely, but it would like this court to consider it in conjunction with those other items. But the reason that the appellant can see that absolutely is because in the jurisdiction of Bluegrass Fort Drum, the appellant was required to submit a signed stipulation signed by himself, his defense counsel, and the trial counsel before the convening authority would even consider entering into a pretrial agreement. So the stipulation in this case seems to be more significant than we usually have in some other cases that have been reviewed by this court, because the convening authority did consider it. He did.
Well, wait a minute. Which way does that cut? Hmm? If the post requires that the stip come with the PTA, doesn't that undercut the contractual importance of the stip? You got to proffer the stip to even go into negotiations on a PTA, it would seem. So which way does that cut?
At the same time, having done that before the offer was accepted by the committee,
well,
means that the appellant had fulfilled that promise before.
Wait a minute. He fulfilled that promise in the sense that he proffered a stip, but he did that as a means to enter into negotiations, right?
Exactly.
Okay, well, then that seems to undercut the importance of the stip as subsequent performance.
As subsequent performance, perhaps that's correct.
Okay.
But the appellant's argument is that once the convening authority had reviewed that and tacitly approved it by accepting the deal, obviously not only did the parties, the trial counsel, defense counsel, and appellant believe that that was a stip that would be used at trial, so did the convening authority. And when the government tried to modify that stip to contain information that it would not otherwise be able to put before that court martial, it was an improper reason for the withdrawal.
How do you respond to the government's argument that the provision in paragraph 3C of the agreement, that there was a disagreement as to a material term of the contract?
The government contends in their brief, at least, that the material disagreement was to an implied term of no further misconduct. And the appellant's first response would be, if that is their position, that there was no implied term, that he would conduct no further misconduct.
Well, what about the disagreement over whether performance had begun or not begun? The meaning of that. I mean, it seems to me that that's one of the major issues that was discussed.
I understand your question, Your Honor, and to respond to that, the paragraph 3C is essentially just a restatement of the provisions
the rule.
Of 705. And even if those provisions aren't in a pretrial agreement, I hell would argue 705 is going to apply to every pretrial agreement. And if the government's right that a dispute as to when performance begins or what that term means is not a meeting of the minds, there's never going to be a meeting of the minds because the case law itself does not define what beginning performance means, and it's always going to be fact specific. So it's always going to be a disagreement potentially between the government and the appellant when you're looking at the beginning of performance. So that
this gives a trap door.
The government, any, no matter what happens, that rule just doesn't mean anything. The government can always withdraw. And obviously, the president's intent when promulgating that rule was to set some limits on the government on when they could withdraw from a pretrial agreement, clearly trying to give the appellant some understanding of what they're dealing with and how they're going to be treated when they're negotiating with the government. And if the government wants to make rules for themselves that give more rights to the appellants, then this court should uphold those rules and then hold the government to the standard it set for itself.
Do you think that's a material term?
Beginning performance. As since it is, it's in the rule, and it's also in there, it is a material term. But as the argument for appellant is that beginning performance is always going to be factual. So it's always going to be a dispute when it began. It should not be ground in every case just to really know the agreement. There should be some sort of showing that that was the disagreement. And
so your argument is that that term is so ambiguous that it defies definition, and so there can always be an argument. I'm not quite following that.
It doesn't defy definition, but in order to try to understand what the president meant by when he promulgated that rule, the analysis goes into Shepherdson and says, in Shepherdson, the court had found a theory of detrimental reliance to provide a remedy for an appellant when there was a withdrawal from the pretrial agreement. In Shepherdson, the standard was any action upon which there's detrimental reliance could be grounds for relief. The president said, hey, I'm not going to use that standard. I'm going to say beginning performances of specific promises contained in the pretrial agreement. And he doesn't talk about or say, hey, promises plus detrimental reliance. So he's contemplating that the beginning performance means if you say you're going to do something in the pretrial agreement, that promise when you do it is the beginning of performance. And that analysis also contemplates that performance could be given before entering the plea. In this case, the opponent did everything except get to enter the plea, which was prevented on the eve of the trial.
And under your theory, detrimental reliance is no longer relevant under 705?
That would be appellant's theory, yes, Your Honor. Even if detrimental reliance were to be held required by this court, appellant in this case did detrimentally rely. He waived witnesses. There was clearly in the record some indication that part of the negotiations in this deal were because the government and the defense were anticipating that witnesses for trial were about to deploy sometime in the late September. In this case, there were three previous trial dates that through August and September, there was delays that occurred, and as a result of those delays, the witnesses did deploy, and appellant was not able to, he requested, but was not able to get the government to produce those witnesses at trial.
Did this STIP contain anything that wasn't otherwise available to government?
Say again, Your Honor, please.
Did this STIP contain information of a confessional nature that was otherwise unavailable to the government?
No, Your Honor.
It did not.
It did not, Your Honor. The appellant also definitely lied because though he was still perhaps permitted to enter a plea of guilty. It's clear that the trial defense counsel did not enter that plea. I believe in going really infer this because there was no conditional plea given by the government, and he probably didn't believe that he would be able to preserve an appeal issue for the adverse ruling of the military judge permitting the government to withdraw from this agreement. So he also had to enter a not guilty plea and didn't get the benefit of that deal. And if this court looks to what actually occurred at trial, what occurred at trial essentially was that he entered a not guilty plea. And what he got was essentially what he had agreed to in the terms of the pretrial agreement. He got the two non-level witnesses, which he requested. None of the witnesses he requested, which he waived in the pretrial agreement, were produced for trial. The only ones produced were the government witnesses on the merits to prove up their case.
Counsel, I'm trying to determine what, if anything, is left of the concept of detrimental reliance in light of the rule. Does the rule replace the concept of detrimental reliance, or does it articulate in part the concept of detrimental reliance? Where do we look for the standard in assessing this case or any other case where the convening authority withdraws?
I would argue that the court should first look to the rule and what the standard in the rule is, and that the detrimental reliance theory in the case law is just an alternative theory of relief. And there may be facts where there's a withdrawal or there's detrimental reliance or there's other actions taken by the appellant that aren't in the pretrial agreement that may qualify for that detrimental reliance relief. But first, the court should look to Rule 705. The government has set its own standard when it would withdraw and should be held to that standard. That's clearly giving an indication to an appellant. This is what you can expect when you negotiate with the government. Here's the rules we're going to abide by. If we don't abide by them,
see, I'm trying to figure out where detrimental reliance would apply when it's not in the rule. Let's take the case of an individual who he has a pretrial agreement, does nothing to prepare for having witnesses at trial based upon the anticipation that there's going to be a guilty plea, and on the eve of trial, the convening authority withdraws. The accused has done nothing affirmatively to begin performance at that point. Let's assume that's the type of case, no stipulation or any other factor there. Now, the accused there is detrimentally relied, but wouldn't the remedy there be for the judge to continue the case and give an opportunity to prepare as opposed to enforcing a pretrial agreement?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and that would be obviously a case that's really on point for where detrimental reliance applied. And if he didn't give that relief, perhaps there would be another error before the court for ineffective assistance of counsel of that nature. And the case law seems to anticipate that is really where detrimental reliance would apply, is because you do see cases where the appellant hasn't performed any promises up until the date of trial. But here we have a case where he has performed. He entered this. He entered his forum selection as judge alone. He waived his witnesses. He specifically didn't require the government to produce any of those witnesses. And then at trial, what he got was essentially what he had bargained for, except for he now had to enter a plea of not guilty. At the end of the day, what this court has before it is a government who had a deal with the accused. On the eve of trial, they got some information about uncharged misconduct, which would not be permitted to be put before that court martial, because it was a general court martial. They would have had to have a 32 on this misconduct if they had wanted it referred. They would have to have the accused waive his waiver or his joinder objection. And they obviously couldn't put this in sentencing under any of the rules for aggravation, because it didn't fit those rules, because it wasn't related to the offenses. And they had no way to get this in front of that court. They wanted it in front of the court. The appellant wouldn't play ball, so they said, we're not going to give you the benefit of the deal. We're going to continue with the court martial. And by the way, we're going to court martial you again for this uncharged misconduct. And it was just a situation which the government was just not pleased, and it was an arbitrary reason for them to withdraw. Therefore, the appellant would request that this court disapprove any sentence, which includes confinement in excess of 24 months. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Captain Mark Goodson, and I, along with Colonel Denise Lind, represent the United States in this appeal. This court should affirm the court below because the military judge properly decided that the convening authority could withdraw from the pretrial agreement at issue in this case. This court reviews a military judge's decision on whether a convening authority may withdraw from a pretrial agreement for an abuse of discretion. And in this case, the military judge did not abuse his discretion for five reasons. First, appellant never began performance under the pretrial agreement at issue here. Second, the parties disagreed as to what beginning performance meant, and by operation of paragraph 3C, the convening authority could properly withdraw. Third, appellant breached his obligation of good faith by committing a new crime. Fourth, he failed to agree to a modified stipulation as required by paragraph 3A of the agreement. And fifth, appellant never detrimentally relied on the agreement here. Turning to each of these arguments.
Well, let's start with, I want to not turn to each of the arguments. I want to start with the implied good faith to not engage in additional misconduct. How do you make that an implied term when under 705C2D, it's an express reason that people can withdraw from a pretrial agreement? It's a very common term in a pretrial agreement.
That one can withdraw from a pretrial agreement? I'm not sure.
That a convening authority can withdraw from a pretrial agreement if the accused engages in additional misconduct between the time of the pretrial agreement and the time of the convening authority taking action. So that would include the time up to trial.
Well, because, Your Honor, in addition to the rule of court martial, there's also the case law, United States v. Koopman, for example, which permits, which reads into the law this notion of implied promises. Koopman is a 1985 case of this court, in which the court found not only an implied promise that the accused would live up to his agreements to provide restitution to the victims in that case, but also found a second implied promise, and that implied promise was an implied promise of good faith. And the court found in that case that was breached by a crime committed by the accused between the time that the accused entered the pretrial agreement and the time that the accused entered the plea.
Okay, well, that was in 1985, and now we have an RCM that has a specific provision that can be placed in a pretrial agreement, and it's a specific provision that often is in a pretrial agreement. So my question to you is, given those two facts, why would we think that that is an implied promise?
for two reasons, Your Honor. RCM 705 was promulgated in 1984. The Koopman decision was in 1985, subsequent to that promulgation. And second, there's no indication that that this is an exclusive set of circumstances under which a convening authority might withdraw, as set forth in RCM 705D4B.
Was the case tried under the 1984 manual or under prior rules?
The case in Koopman, sir?
Yeah.
I don't know offhand, Your Honor. I would have to...
If it was tried under prior rules, then wouldn't that have a bearing on our assessment of its continuing validity?
That would have some bearing, Your Honor. That would.
Are implied promises disfavored or favored?
According to the Cox case, they are disfavored, but that was apparently not the opinion. Cox was decided in 1972. Apparently, that was not the opinion of this court in 1985 when it decided Koopman.
But you concede that under the rule, had the government wanted to put a misconduct provision in the agreement, they could have done so.
Yeah, absolutely, Your Honor. But they also it was not necessary to do so because of the if it's part of the law, it's as if it's written into the contract.
So if there is never I guess your argument is that is implied into every pretrial agreement.
Yes, Your Honor. That's the state of the law and the government's position.
And when you say that appellant never began performance, you don't disagree that there was a waiver of the motion for appropriate relief provided?
Oh, we don't disagree with that.
And you don't disagree that there was a waiver of personal appearance of particular witnesses provided?
Don't disagree with that either, Your Honor. But we also would posit that the appellant, after violating the contract by refusing to modify and committing the additional crimes, filed an Article 13 motion, received relief under it, and with respect to the witnesses in question, suffered no prejudice whatsoever.
But that doesn't go to your assertion that he never began performance. That goes to a very different group of assertions.
Absolutely, Your Honor. That's correct.
So what specifically are you relying on with respect to your assertion that the appellant never began performance, and how is that different from your second assertion, which is that there was a disagreement as to what constituted beginning performance?
He never began performance because he never entered the plea of guilty. It's the government's position that with respect to a pretrial agreement which calls for the entry of a guilty plea, that the appellant does not begin performance until he enters that guilty plea.
And so is it never began performance until performance is completed?
So yes, Your Honor, not completed, excuse me. Performance begins at that time. Appellant must continue to perform because appellant could still seek to withdraw a guilty plea after entering the guilty plea, from the time that the plea is accepted to the time of sentencing. So with respect to the other items of consideration flowing from appellant in this agreement, other than the guilty plea, those are merely items that are preparatory to performance.
What's begin mean?
Begin
means end?
Beginning, no, Your Honor. Beginning means entering the guilty plea. Ending it would mean...
That's paragraph A. What about paragraphs B, C, D, and E? When did he begin on each of those, or F?
At various times, Your Honor, with respect to stipulation that was contemporaneous with the signing of the pretrial agreement.
So that would have been the 24th, I think?
29th of August, 2005, Your Honor.
It wasn't signed by the convening authority until the 14th.
That's correct, but the government's position is...
So at least he began then?
No, Your Honor. He did not begin performance until he never began performance because he did not enter a guilty plea. It's akin to the notion that if I offer someone to $1,000 if they paint my house, they accept the offer by painting the house. But if I also say I want teal trim and white shutters, and I want you to use a number 10 Camel brush, they go out and purchase all those things. But before the first stroke of paint is applied to the house, I rescind the offer and say I don't want this any longer.
That would be
akin to the convening authority's withdrawal in this case. The house painter in that case would be able to get what he or she detrimentally relied on. Reimbursement for the cost of the paint and the brush, for example. if they could show detrimental reliance.
Counsel, if entering into the stipulation is the only promise that counts here, and I believe that's your position.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I couldn't hear what you said.
If entering into the stipulation is the only promise that counts as to determining when performance began.
No, Your Honor, it's entering the guilty plea, not the stipulation.
I'm sorry, yeah, entering the guilty plea. And in your view, that's the only promise that counts. Why then, in both the rule and in the agreement, they talk about promises in the plural?
That's true, Your Honor.
What are they talking about besides the guilty plea?
There are two possibilities there, Your Honor. One, the mayor mentioned of the word promises begs the question as to when the promises would be performed. And that's really what's at issue in this case, is when does performance begin? If appellant can only begin performance by entering the guilty plea, well, then at that time he was also performing all the other promises that are contained in this agreement.
Wouldn't it have been easier for the government to say that, to use the term, entered the guilty plea?
I suppose it would have been, Your Honor, but it would also have been easier to say something akin to that had it in RCM 705, which gets to the second reason, second answer to your question. There may be pretrial agreements which do not call for a guilty plea. For example, call for aid, providing information to government agents, or providing testimony in a companion case, that sort of thing. In that case, there would be multiple promises involved without the necessity of a guilty plea. And in that case, performance could begin under the pretrial agreement by either testifying or providing aid to the government in such a case.
So in this case, if he had pleaded guilty and done none of the other items in the pretrial agreement, he would have begun performance and the community authority could not have withdrawn?
Well, if you pled guilty, theoretically, yes, Your Honor, that would constitute. But as a practical matter, that is not something that the government believes would have occurred. For that's one
because,
of the reasons.
Because the convening authority would have withdrawn before he pleaded guilty.
Well, they could have done that, but that's also one of the reasons for having the stipulation in hand at the time of the signing of the pretrial
agreement. And what if he entered a guilty plea and then withdrew it prior to findings?
That would have been a basis for the convening authority withdrawing, because then he would not have performed. That's the what happened in the penitentiary.
So beginning performance equals performing. I mean, that's what you're saying.
Not entirely, Your Honor, because remember, there is still a course of performance to be followed from the time that the appellant enters the guilty plea to the time that appellant is sentenced. At any point during that period of time, an accused may seek to withdraw. So beginning performance in a case where there is a guilty plea involved would begin at the time of the entry.
Isn't choice of forum a part of the PTA?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, he's got to choose the forum before he enters the plea.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I couldn't hear you.
He's got to go judge alone before he enters the plea.
According to this pretrial agreement, that's true, Your Honor.
Okay, well, if he went judge alone, is that a beginning of performance?
The mayor election of judge alone would not have been beginning.
Isn't that one of the things he's bound to do by the PTA?
That's one of the things that he promises to do, but he's not bound, Your Honor, until he actually enters the plea. It's the government's position that he is not bound by operation.
Isn't that one of the things he agreed to do in the PTA?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. All right. And he says, and the judge says, okay, do you want to be tried by me alone or members? And he says, I want to be tried by you alone. Isn't that partial performance?
No, Your Honor. And it's
Why
interesting
not?
Because it is an act preparatory to performance and not performance itself. And the rule, interestingly, Your Honor, does not, RCM 705 talks about beginning performance. It does not talk about substantial performance, another concept from the contract law.
No, I didn't ask about substantial performance.
You listed five theories.
Beg your pardon?
You listed five theories in which the government prevails. Which is your strongest argument?
That the
if you were deciding this case, which theory would you act upon?
That the mere fact that the parties litigated below, that there was a material disagreement as to a term.
Well, he proffered a PTA. The convening authority said, okay. Then they found about alleged subsequent misconduct. But the convening authority has already bought the PTA. How is there a material disagreement?
Because
you've got the four corners of the agreement.
Yes,
and then you've got parole hanging out here, which is alleged subsequent misconduct.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you vary the four corners of an explicit agreement with parole if we're going to talk contracts?
No, Your Honor. If you can discern the plain meaning from the four corners, you do not then go to the rules of construction.
Okay. Well, and why can't you?
Because it's objective theory of contract. That's the Acevedo case of this court. You look first to the plain meaning of the agreement. But this agreement could had problems with it. For example, the use of the term offenses with respect to what the stipulation, the word offense, singular, as to which the stipulation would apply. Well, that couldn't possibly be what it was meant because there's a patent ambiguity in here. There were offenses, plural, in this agreement. Moreover, turning to the conduct of the parties, one sees that the stipulation actually entered into by the parties included acts of misconduct by the appellant other than the offenses charged here, including acts before appellant ever even entered the military. So the fact that this might have not have come in under RCM 1001 doesn't matter. That is the modification to the stipulation because parties can agree to that. This court's case law permits that. And in fact, had the government wished to rebut, for example, a claim by appellant that he had rehabilitative potential by proving that he had committed this intervening larceny, then in that case the government was perfectly permitted to do so. The government lost the benefit of the bargain in this agreement when appellant committed the new misconduct precisely because of that. Prior to appellant's commission of the crimes in this the second set of crimes in this case, the government was able to prove up its case both on merits and sentencing simply by having appellant plead guilty, entering the stipulation of fact, and being done with it. After appellant committed the crime, by contrast, the government then had to produce witnesses if it wished to prove up the subsequent
conduct. That's because the government withdrew from the pretrial agreement.
Because the appellant refused to modify as he was obliged to do under paragraph 3A.
Do you see how circular your argument is? Never mind.
What does paragraph 3A mean?
Paragraph 3A means the parties agree to agree. It's like any other contract to agree. They have to come to reach some point in the future. They have to agree what some modification would be. And if they fail to do that, then the agreement is canceled.
So essentially the agreement is to either party could withdraw from the agreement at any time. The government, by recommending a modification that the appellant wouldn't accept.
So long as there was a good faith basis, Your Honor, for proposing such a modification, the answer is yes.
What makes a good faith modification? Well, where does that come from and what determines whether something's good faith?
Well,
it says any modification.
It does, although I would submit that if there was a modification in bad faith, that attempted modification by the government in bad faith, then that would not be a permissible grounds for the government seeking to withdraw. But in this case, the military judge found as a matter of fact that there was no bad faith on the part of the government, finding a fact which the government submits is reviewable only under a clearly erroneous standard, and there's no evidence to suggest otherwise in this case. The government was within its bounds, as the military judge determined.
Counsel, as I read the rule, it says that the convening authority can withdraw when inquiry by the military judge discloses a disagreement as to a material term in the agreement. My understanding of the sequence of facts in this case is that the convening authority withdrew before that point.
That is yes, Your Honor.
And isn't the purpose of that point to deal with a situation when the military judge is doing a providence inquiry and then there is a disagreement as to what a term means and the convening authority says, well, if we're in a situation here where the military judge has disclosed a problem with it, I'm out of the agreement. Isn't that the sequence that's talked about in the rule?
Not necessarily, okay. Your Honor. The rule does not describe the sequence of events which must lead up to the inquiry by the military judge or when the disclosure must occur. In fact, this was prompted by the...
But it says the convening authority may withdraw the convening authority had already withdrawn here before the military judge even got his hands on the agreement.
Well, the convening authority withdrew, but the approval of that withdrawal, I mean, if the military judge could have negated that withdrawal by ruling in favor of the defense at that point. So the sequence of events is set forth in the rule. There is no sequence of events set forth by the rule. It doesn't describe when that must occur.
So it's the government's view that when an individual makes a pretrial agreement that doesn't have a subsequent misconduct provision, that and if the individual does everything that's required in the agreement, that on the eve of trial, the convening authority can say, either you confess to these other crimes of which you've been accused, and by the way, we'll use that confession against you in a subsequent trial, or there's no agreement. Or is there a protection for not using that stipulation in a subsequent trial?
I don't know that it's the government position that they would have a confession, although it would seem to be tantamount, perhaps, to that, because we don't know. I'm not entirely sure what the proposed stipulation was in this case. But the upshot is, yes, the government can withdraw up till any point, up to the entry of a plea. And that's the whole, that's in fact what happened in this, as held by this court in the Shepherdson case, as held by the Supreme Court of the United States in Mabry. In that case, the Shepherdson case, there was simply a change in the convening authority. In Mabry, there was simply a change of prosecutor. And because there was no detrimental reliance on the part of the defendant in Mabry.
Where do the words detrimental reliance appear in the rule?
Detrimental reliance does not appear in the rule, Your Honor.
So why should that make any difference? If we're applying the plain meaning of the rule, does it make any difference whether there's detrimental reliance if the conditions of the rule are met?
Absolutely, Your Honor, because this may a decision to that effect may actually be near to the benefit of an accused in future cases. The reason for that being, if an accused has not performed and they are somehow harmed, They've not begun performance, but are somehow harmed by entering into a pretrial agreement and relying upon it. Then, in that case, you would have a remedy available to.
But that would raise a legal theory external to the rule, whether it be a due process theory or another theory that detrimental reliance would apply. Applying the rule itself, as I understand the government's position, is even if the rule would prohibit the convening authority from withdrawing, that if there's been no detrimental reliance, the rule is X'd out and doesn't apply.
Not X'd out, Your Honor. It is a rule that is external. The notion of detrimental reliance is external to the rule.
Well, then you are arguing that point, that if the rule is complied with and the convening authority is prohibited by the rule from withdrawing, nonetheless, if there's no detrimental reliance, then the rule doesn't apply.
No, Your Honor, that's not the government's position. If I may briefly explain, because
sure.
I see I'm
take,
out of time.
Take your time, because I'm trying to figure out the relationship between the rule and detrimental reliance.
If the rule is violated and by the appellant actually beginning performance, then the government is bound by the agreement. In that case,
even if there's no detrimental reliance.
There would have to be no showing of detrimental reliance. In all likelihood, there would be some harm, but the appellant would not be required to prove up detrimental reliance. In that case, the court could then specifically enforce the agreement, even though that's an equitable remedy. It would be as a matter of breach of contract rather than the equitable remedy of promissory estoppel, which would be the remedy an accused would seek prior to that time.
Thank you. You may take a moment to summarize if you'd like to.
Thank you. This court has repeatedly held that the convening authority may withdraw from a pretrial agreement that calls for a guilty plea at any time prior to the entry of that guilty plea, unless there has been detrimental reliance. That harmonizes with RCM 705. The analysis of RCM 705, which says it is consistent with, and I quote, consistent with Shepherdson. This court's opinions decided before and after the rule's promulgation in contract theory. Since appellant fails to show detrimental reliance in this case, we respectfully request that you affirm the decision with the law.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
First point is, let there be no mistake, the government hasn't lost anything in this case when they withdrew from the agreement. It's all to the detriment of the appellant. The government's reliance on Koopman is misplaced because the facts in Koopman were a little bit different. In Koopman, you had a pretrial agreement in which the government was seeking to have the, as a term of the agreement, to have the appellant repay debts that were created by bad checks. And as time went on, that agreement modified, and the first was pay all of them, then it became pay most of them. And unless I'm mistaken, it appears the good faith required there was the good faith on the part of the appellant to fulfill that term by making good faith efforts to repay the debts. And it had nothing to do with a implied term, as the government seems to be not good faith to imply terms to a pretrial agreement. And finally, to respond, Judge Efron, to a question you had for me, which was, does the you have a case where no promises have been fulfilled, and the government withdraws, is the remedy to give a delay to correct perhaps any detriment play potentially due to a lack of preparation by the trial defense counsel? Clearly, in this record, there was some sort of appearance of detrimental reliance by the defense counsel because the judge specifically asked on the joint appendix, page 35, when he asked the defense counsel, so are you suggesting you haven't prepared for trial by interviewing your witnesses? And the response was, well, who's to be sure? Clearly, the appellant wasn't necessarily prepared, and the delay didn't cure that remedy because there was also some indication in the record that there were some difficulties with the defense counsel contacting those witnesses he was trying to compel production of, and perhaps those difficulties contacting them in the combat operations also contributed to his inability to present an adequate proffer to change the ruling of the judge to actually compel the government to produce those witnesses. So the delay in this case didn't even correct if there was any lack of preparation by the defense counsel. And ultimately, at trial, again, the appellant had what he had in the deal, which was his evidence was all by stipulation. He got his two non-local witnesses. And if you read the record of trial, it kind of looks like the defense counsel in this case, though they entered a formal not guilty plea, looks like a slow move because there was really no challenge to the government's case other than the 1917 motion at the end of the government's presentation of evidence. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. The case is now submitted. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today, and the court will be in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.